From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Namdi. Tom Sherwood, he's our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon.
And joining us in studio is Gregory Dean. He is chief of the district's fire and EMS department. Chief Dean, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
If you have questions or comments for the chief, give us a call at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Watch the conversation on our live video stream at our website, kojoshow.org, or shoot us a tweet at kojoshow. Tom Sherwood, Mayor Bowser, and several regional leaders are off to Cuba, a place that you visited recently. And I noticed that even though NBC4 has sent a reporter, it was not you.
Well, David Culver's going, and he's Cuban-American, I might add. He went there last year with his family members who had not been back to Cuba since the 60s and did a lot of nice stories about it. I actually heard about this trip in the early January, and I was going to go, but I missed by one day being able to apply for a journalism visa. I had a visa for educational visit, but it wasn't good enough and wasn't up to date, so I didn't go. I would love to have gone again. It's a remarkable place. We've got 41 people going from the region.
You wrote that it's a significant opportunity, a significant economic opportunity for just about any jurisdiction in the region.
Well, yeah, well, any business in America, frankly. I mean, you know, I think there's a story in the Post today about how Virginia is the leading state in the nation with agricultural interests in Cuba. I mean, the whole place, it's 700 square miles, I mean, 700 miles long. It's 11 million people. They need everything that a modern society could offer. It's got tremendous business opportunities for every imaginable thing you can do. So I'm not criticizing this trip. It's only for 4 or 5 days, and I think it's the opening to Cuba that a lot of people in this country have wanted.
Well, here's something you may want to criticize. You have certainly criticized it in the past, but its future in the eyes of some people look bright. What exactly do you think the hashtag #choo-choo7 is? You know what the #choo-choo7 is?
I do not know. That music is faster than Frank Sinatra, so I don't know.
It's the D.C. streetcar opening for business to passengers on Saturday, February 27th. Mayor Bowser's team has put out a hashtag called #choo-choo7 that Loose Lips couldn't figure out what #choo-choo7 went until he inquired and found that the date of it is 227, and to some people that sounds like #choo-choo7.
Well, that may be... Well, you know, that streetcar is not a laughing matter for, I don't care what they call about it, $200+ million to go a couple of miles. And it's finally, unless somebody in the safety fire department changes their mind.
Is it ready to go, Chief Dean?
That's what they say.
Yes, it is.
So they're going to open it. It's going to be running. I repeat my suggestion that they put a bar on a couple of those cars and just make some money off of them. But they're going to open. It's going to be free for an undetermined amount of time, maybe 30-plus days. I still have not heard how they're going to charge people. I don't think there's a fare box, the typical fare box there. I don't know if people are going to throw coins in a fishbowl. I just don't know how it's going to work. Do you know, Chief?
I'm not aware of how they plan on doing that, but around the country, when you see their light rail systems, they use the merit system. There's a lot of ways.
The merit system.
Which is
good free rides for all.
No, because you actually have people that come on and check, and you can be fined if you don't have your ticket with you.
It's kind of like going on the Amtrak. You go to New York, and the conductor comes along, and you got to show him something to
Correct.
Prove you're there.
Correct.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Joel Rubin. He's a candidate for Maryland's 8th Congressional District. But right now, we're talking with Gregory Dean. He is chief of the district's fire and EMS. So call now, 800-433-8850. Before we go to Chief Dean, the death this past weekend of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, prominent, of course, in writing the opinion District versus Heller that changed D.C.'s very strict gun laws and made them somewhat looser.
Yes, major, one of his major decisions on the court. It essentially clarified for the country that the Second Amendment was not just for militia to have guns, but you have a right to have a firearm in your home. And the city still has not finished writing and rewriting the laws to accommodate that. I think there's still some lower court issues about what the law is now. But a significant decision, the city leaders hated, but the Supreme Court ruled, and now they're trying to adjust to it. I'll be going to the funeral tomorrow for Channel 4.
You'll be covering the funeral?
I'll be recovering it to see what's happened.
It can also have an effect on the future of former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, because his case is set to go before the Supreme Court. And depending on how the vote turns out, he could either be a free man or an individual headed for incarceration.
Yes. Some of the justices, I'm not sure which ones there were, said that they would take a look at his argument that what he did, what he was convicted of, was just routine politics, doing things for constituents, and there was no quid pro quo, and that the laws that the federal prosecutors had brought against him and the jury accepted would criminalize the conduct of politics in this country. Sounds like a really big case, but now that there is a 4-4, that there's only 8 members, we're not sure exactly where that will go in the Supreme Court.
On to Chief Gregory Dean. It's been a dramatic couple of weeks in your department, Chief Dean. Last week, your medical director, Juliet Saucy, quit, citing a range of problems from a lack of accountability to issues with responsiveness of medics on duty. She was someone fairly highly regarded in the field and, according to some, will be difficult to replace. Can you give us any idea of how and when you'll be able to choose a replacement for her?
Well, currently we have an interim medical director, Dr. Robert Holman, and we've been working with Howard University to ensure that we continue to move forward and provide medical care here and medical care supervision throughout the district.
How does that work with Howard University?
Well, Howard is actually looking at, has offered to come in and look at the training we're giving to help us to make sure we're providing the correct training and to anything else they could do to ensure that we continue to provide great care here in the district.
It just seems that you have been the fire chief since what month last year?
May.
And when you first came, you said you'd spend at least 6 months or so getting your feet on the ground. You've been going to talk to people. It just seems to still kind of, what training hasn't been done? It seems to me like basic training would have been done in the past, that you don't have to have a university come in, all this great hour to help out. That this should be just standard operating procedure to know what to do.
Well, when I talk about Howard and talk about the training, is that the everyone here is nationally registered emergency medical technicians or paramedics, so they have the training. What we've asked is, can we take a look at how we're doing training? Can we improve the training? Are there other areas? So the review of how we handle, you're always doing that. So when I came out of Seattle, where we had the medical doctors attached to the hospital, they were always reviewing the reports to see if we should upgrade them. They were always looking at the training we provided to see if there are things we should do and how we do things. And so in the CQI, which is the...
No, CQI?
Say it again.
What was CQI?
CQI is the quality control, to be able to see how you're doing and judge if we're following all the policies and everything else.
It seems like a management issue that it's not that whether people are not trained to what to do when they get on the scene, but a management issue of just dispatching properly and getting and knowing that the people will know what to do when they get to the scene.
Well, again...
and the getting them to the scene.
All three of those, and that's why we came in and started talking about providing a third-party provider to allow that to be the bridge to get into those issues, which is more training. The way we currently do training was that we were just requiring them to be recertified every 2 years. I truly believe if we're going to be good at medicine, we have to do it on a more regular basis, like monthly. I also believe that we could not get to the issue of preventative maintenance without slowing these vehicles down and being able to do that. And the third piece that stood out is the fact that some of these men and women get on these ambulances and they leave at 7 o'clock in the morning. They don't come back until 2. And being able to ensure that people get just the normal, hey, can I get some food to keep my energy up? Can I get a bathroom break? Is some of the challenges that we have currently.
So you think you have a qualified staff. You just need to better manage that staff and give them the support so they can do the job.
Yes.
The medical director who resigned said that proposals and reform efforts were stymied at the top. I'm assuming, Chief Dean, she means you, including a refusal to address what she called a culture of indifference. What's your response to that?
Well, the way we've done things, the medical director as well as everybody else was involved in moving forward. As you know, last Friday, we signed a contract with American Medical Response to provide the third-party provider. We continue to try to move things forward. We retained the previous medical director through December of last year to assist on the medical side of things. Were there challenges? Yes. But overall, I'd like to think that we're continuing to move forward. We're continuing to take advantage of the opportunity to improve the service that we have for the community.
Some people would say that she gave up too early, that if you're coming in to change a system that people would say for decades has not been properly managed or properly organized, that she was there less than a year, about seven months. So, yeah, that she gave up too soon. Do you agree with that? I know you don't want to sit here and trash her, even if you personally might want to. Do you think she gave up too soon, or was she an ill fit? Some people have said both.
So, again, I can't answer on either one. Here's what I know. We had major challenges. When I came here, I said we had major challenges. And you've got to be willing to stay and fight through all those challenges. We are continuing to try to provide confidence, and that is really a major word. So the confidence of this community has been shooken by the idea that they're not getting great medical care. And I would say to you that out of the 200,000 plus alarms we go on annually, 160,000 of those are EMS. The majority of those are handled appropriately. And so we need to look at this as a great opportunity, the light shining on us, to show and demonstrate to this community how well we can do. So I actually like the challenge. I want my men and women to accept this challenge, and I want us to go out there and continue to provide the same excellence.
What has been your experience with the D.C. Fire and EMS Department, and what do you think should be done to improve it? You can call us at 800-433-8850 as we talk with the chief of that department, Gregory Dean. You had a grilling on Wednesday at a marathon D.C. Council hearing led by the Judiciary Committee. There was a great deal of criticism and testimony from Saucers and others during that hearing, but I didn't hear any specific suggestions about what you need to be doing. What did you take from that hearing that you can see as something you can implement in the short or long term?
I think it was important for the council to hear and understand all the different things going on, and to determine if we are taking our responsibilities seriously. We continue to move forward. I think you're always, anytime you bring change someplace, you're going to have people that will look at it and not be comfortable with change. So my takeaway from that meeting was it was a great opportunity for us, after there was the criticism we received, to sit before the council and assure them of what we've done, where we were headed, and how we plan to incorporate the plan that they had agreed to in October.
No. So Chief Mary Che, the Ward 3 council member, said she was, I think, losing faith.
Losing
the
faith.
Phrase. Losing faith.
Don't know that she had any in the department.
Well, no, she was. She was part of the reform effort of to get the department moving. But when someone says they're losing faith, that's not a good sign. But do you feel like you reassured her in any way? Have you talked to her since Wednesday? A lot of people in this part of town, the north part of town, depend upon the Bethesda Chevy Chase private ambulance service, you know, to come get them and take them to hospitals and things when they need them, rather than calling our own city ambulances. Is Mary Che right to be losing faith?
Well, I talked to the council member prior to the hearing. Council member had an opportunity to hear things, and hopefully, as time goes on, we will regain the council member's faith by our demonstration of our ability to do our job and do our job properly.
Can you talk about reforms that you have enacted that you think might be able to restore the faith of the council?
Well, again, what we have done since I've been here is that we gave the first test that's happened in 8 years. We had over 3,700 people apply. We are starting a recruit class here in the next couple of weeks. Off that list, we went out and got a SAFER grant, which allows us to hire 42 paramedics. We'll be starting that class in April. We have just signed the contract to bring in a third-party provider that allows us to be able to get to the core issues that I think are important for the organization, which is training, preventative maintenance, which impacts our ability to do our job effectively.
You talk about the training. I've gotten a text message here from someone in the city who says, who wrote the training curriculum? Who will supervise training if there is no medical director? And what if the new director disagrees with the training? How much autonomy would that person have?
So you got a lot of questions. Let's see if we can take one at a time.
Who wrote the training curriculum?
The prior curriculum was developed with previous medical directors.
Okay. And if there's no medical director, who supervises the training so that the people who are training will know more than the people who are getting trained?
So even to provide care on the street on a daily basis, we have to have a medical director. So we do have an interim medical director, Dr. Robert Holman. So there is a medical director here.
And what if the new director or disagrees with the training you're offering? Can he or she change it?
Absolutely. That is the reason why the medical director did it the first time. They will look at all the roles, because the role of an emergency medical technician, which is basic life support, is not as great as the role of a paramedic that has to know a lot more information to be able to operate outside of the hospital.
Can I ask a question about the private ambulance service? I think a lot of people, I'm getting ignored by the host. Yes, here we go. I'm going to ask it anyway. How will the private ambulance service, I have right now, if I were to have a heart attack or felt ill enough for someone to call an ambulance, who's going to come? Is it going to be your ambulance service, or is it going to be the private service that you intend to put in place? How is that decision going to be made, and how quickly will it be made?
And that's an excellent question, because all of the reports that I have seen indicate that the private service will be for low priority calls. And I want to know how you make that distinction between what's a low priority call and a high priority call. They're all emergencies to most people.
So I'm actually glad you guys are asking this. So really, this is the meat and potatoes of what's going on around here. And the ideal is this, is that regardless of your emergency, if you call 911, you are going to get a DC fire and EMS personnel to respond to your resident. When they get there, they will evaluate you. They will do their patient assessment. Based on that patient assessment, they'll make a determination as to whether you are non-life-threatening. And if you're non-life-threatening, then they would call for the private ambulance to transport you. If you have a life-threatening situation, the paramedics either will be on that response or they will call for the DC fire and EMS paramedics to treat you and transport you. The ambulance personnel are also emergency medical technicians. They'll be
the
licensed.
The private,
yes. Yeah. They'll be licensed by the Department of Health, just like our people are, and they will have the same level of training. So when we transfer care, it will remain the same. You're not getting less care. You're getting the same amount of care.
We've had situations where the EMS responders have either gone to the wrong address or didn't get, you've heard the horror stories. What happens if the private ambulance service messes up a phone call? And so somebody's adjudged not to be critical, but then the person gets into the private ambulance and maybe they die because they didn't get care fast enough. Who's responsible? Is it, do I sue the city or do I sue the private ambulance service?
So the way it works is that the private ambulance, we will be on scene until the private ambulance gets there. So that level of care remains. It's not a matter of we look at you and say, okay, and call for a private ambulance and leave. We have to transfer care to the private ambulance. So no one will be left alone while they wait for a
private
ambulance.
Not like you're calling Uber to take them somewhere.
Correct. Okay. Correct. Secondly, the question is, if a patient's condition changes, the way the contract reads is that we will decide, should we send an ALS unit to provide additional care for that, or if they're close enough to the hospital, should they proceed to the hospital? Those decisions will be made as we go. That is very normal. Most of the time, my experience after 45 years in Seattle is that it's really the if you're doing low acuity patients, non-life threatening, is that that does not happen very often.
And when does this start?
This is scheduled to start in about 4 to 6 weeks.
Four to six weeks.
Yes.
Okay. Put on your headphones, please, gentlemen, because we are now about to hear from Ade in Southeast Washington. Ade, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. How you doing?
Doing well.
Actually, I was just calling to say we had a fire sometime in the summer, and we thought that everything was taken care of pretty well, although they did trash the house in the process of putting out the fire. But the service we received made us really proud residents, and we had even they contact paired us. I think it was either the Salvation Army or Red Cross, and they came over and helped. I mean, we just felt like really good residents, and someone from the mayor's office came, and even though it was a bad situation, we were happy about the service we received. So I just wanted to say it's not all bad. Good things are happening, and I just wanted to say that.
Well, you actually expected that they would come and put out the fire in your home without disrupting the arrangements at the dining table?
They could put out the house without having to tear the ceiling. And
all right, thanks. Thank you very much. At least that was some.
Well, you know, Mark Seagraves, who covers your issue, center,
right.
He had a fire at his house, and something with the ashes in the fireplace, and the fire department came in and did something. I don't know the whole story, but he was actually impressed too. So it isn't that people are not doing their jobs or there aren't well qualified people.
And most of the problems have not been the reported problems have not been so much around fires as with the emergency technicians. One of the problems that your former medical director cited that's really mysterious to me is she talked about people, EMTs, who disappear in hospitals while on duty. What is your understanding of what could cause an EMT to be difficult to find in a hospital situation?
Well, the as I understand it, the members are trying to go grab something to eat because they've been on the road since 7 o'clock.
You mentioned
o'clock
earlier about people
right,
trying
are,
to
are
find
being able to go to the bathroom, take a break like that. So at one point, we actually had hospital liaison officers at 3 of the hospitals to help assist in doing that. So we've tried to address issues as they came up, but we recognize that we are running these vehicles and these people very hard, and there are challenges with that.
Even the most dedicated employee will be burned out if he or she isn't treated with some dignity themselves.
Here now is Max in Rockville, Maryland. Max, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, good morning, sir. Afternoon, sir. I'm a firefighter in Montgomery County. I just wanted to bring up the topic, or really have a question for you. Being that we put so much emphasis on fire prevention, and it seems to be pretty effective, is there any solutions you can think of more medical prevention to prevent the low priority calls that seem to burn out so many EMTs?
Chief Dean.
So thanks for the question. I think the answer is this, is that one of the things we're doing is we're working with the Department of Health and other agencies to reduce the number of low priority calls that we actually respond to. Even coming here, and we decided to bring in a private ambulance to help unload some of our call volume. Some of these low call volumes, as we get better, we would not have to respond to, simply because it allows us an opportunity to prepare the public. Also, the public needs to understand that we are emergency response. So being able to call us to say, I know on Tuesday that I have an appointment on Thursday that I want you to transport me, are things that we have to correct. And so
Marion Barry used to complain about that during his administration, claiming that there were some people in remote parts of the city who felt that the emergency medical service was akin to a taxi service to take them to the hospital
anytime
they needed
purposes,
to go. For medical
purposes, that continues to be the case. I don't know if that in terms of the volume and number of cases, how big that is. What percentage of the calls would you say, the 160-something thousand calls a year, do you think are, I don't want to say frivolous,
but
maybe not calls?
So I don't have a percentage for you, but I know it impacts.
It's a few thousand?
Probably more than a few thousand. I would say the tens. But it impacts availability. And again, it's educating the public to understand this is an emergency service. This is not just a service. And that is why we're working with the Department of Health and some of the other city agencies, because it's not just a fire department problem. It is a problem that we have to resolve for the district.
Here is Bill in Ashburn, Virginia. Bill, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. Chief Dean, I wanted to just maybe give some kudos to you. You and I actually met many years ago when I attended the Resuscitation Academy in Seattle. And I think that people don't appreciate that you're coming from a system that is considered the finest EMS system in the country. And to implement the changes that you want to make here, just it's going to take time. It's not going to happen at a drop of a dime. And I've heard a lot of questions dealing with the private ambulance service, but that model is used in many cities throughout the country, not only Seattle, but Toledo, Ohio, was used in Miami City at one point. I'm still not sure if they do that, but it's a common practice to make sure that the primary units are available for the true emergency calls while the low acuity is handled by others. So it shouldn't be a shock to anyone, and I want to congratulate you for your work that you did in Seattle and what you're going to be able to bring in time here to the D.C. area.
How much time?
Is that what you see as the biggest obstacle here, time?
So what I think is that anytime you change something, you have to get buy-in, and we have things we have to prove. One of the things I did, we were talking about the Resuscitation Academy. I actually sent Dr. Saucy and Chief Mills out to Seattle in October to take a look at how we can improve our cardiac saves, and additionally, I had them stay a couple extra days just to have an opportunity to see how the system worked so that we could start imagining how we're going to do this and how it's going to work. And so we needed to do buy-in within the organization. I think we do have buy-in. We we've got the council that has agreed to give us an opportunity to see if we can change the system. So in the next 4 to 6 weeks, we'll start seeing ambulances on the street. We are going to evaluate this, and what we've said is that we will very clearly allow everybody to weigh in to see if we've impacted the system, to say that our members have more training hours, that we're able to do more preventative maintenance on our vehicles, as well as improve the overall department. So I think you have to be visible, even when there's a lot going on.
We got an email from Mike in Southeast D.C., who obviously knows more about firehouses than I do. He says, firehouses, like most D.C. neighborhoods, lack parking space, so you can't station enough ambulances at stations around town. Why not use motorcycle EMTs to provide triage and stabilize patients if need be? Your personnel will eagerly compete for those specializations, and you have room for cycles at existing facilities.
So I actually did a study in Seattle looking at motorcycles because they came to me and said, hey, they're doing this in Miami and other places. One of the challenges always is two-part. I like people working in teams. And secondly is that responding on a motorcycle makes you very vulnerable, and you do not have to be wrong to have things bad happen to you. I like using fire trucks to do the evaluation for a couple of reasons. I've got four people there. If it's not a medical emergency, they can turn right around in their fire truck and they can go to other emergencies. So I think we need to get good at what we have and then start looking at other options.
I still have a hard time understanding the fire truck responding to a medical emergency, even though you do need to run the fire trucks to keep them in good shape. Rather than a motorcycle, I always thought something more on the lines of a Jeep, something that has some heft to it, or two people could be in, and get to make that quick decision, stabilize a patient, call the private ambulance service, or make certain that the advance ambulances on the way.
So we have our ambulances. We have 14 medic units in the district. We have 25 ambulances.
The difference between a medic unit and an ambulance?
So the difference is that an ambulance has emergency medical technicians on it, very similar to what's on the fire truck, and the medic units have paramedics on them.
Here is Jordan in Washington, D.C. Jordan, your turn.
Good afternoon, Chief Dean. I have relatives that work in the District of Columbia Fire Department, and it seems to me that the crux of the problem is the education of the public and the public understanding what constitutes an emergency. We have very aggressive campaigns about teenage pregnancy in the past and saying no to drugs. And we even had an instance in the District of Columbia, I believe, during the Marion Barry era, where there was a campaign, a public campaign for the residents to understand what constitutes an emergency, but it was broadcast at 2 o'clock in the morning, where no one was able to see. And I was wondering what you intend to do to educate the public so that it frees up some of our EMTs and our ALS units so that they can go to the emergencies, what constitutes an emergency, as opposed to wasting units and time for things that are not emergencies.
Chief Dean.
Great question.
As you heard me say, we're working with the Department of Health and other agencies to be able to put something together that we actually can train the public in. At the same time, we're also, thank you for reminding me, we're also doing Hands on Heart, which is teaching everybody in the district how to do CPR. We started this in October, and through today, we've got trained over 4,000 people. The reason I mention that is simply this, is that there are many ways to remind people how important it is to keep these emergency vehicles free so that we can take care of each other. And doing Hands on Heart, educating the public. And there's one more piece that's important to me. We also are looking to start a campaign where we teach people to pull to the right so emergency vehicles can get through. It is important that we do all three of these at the same time.
I was in the 12th Street Tunnel this morning, and the ambulance came off of Independence Avenue into the tunnel, and every lane was blocked. And I thought, well, how is that going to happen? But sure enough, the people, you could see the cars. Some people are, you know, got stuck like scared rabbits, but most people started moving over and the ambulance got through. I was surprised that it happened as quickly as it did.
We're just about out of time. You have been reported as being well-liked by the firefighters and firefighters and EMTs. Are you able, does that help you with being able to reform things? Is that a good thing? Some people would think that's a bad thing. You should never get along with them.
Well, I think relationships are always a good thing. Having relationships with everyone is actually who I am. I still need to make decisions, and decisions are a critical part of anybody. One of the questions that came up in council chambers was, hey, we don't think that your people want to do EMS. And I thought, and I answered the question with, but that's what I'm hiring to do. I'm the boss. If they don't want to do EMS, then they have to make a decision. So you can be friends with people and still do your job. There's nothing that stops you from doing both at the same time.
The department has had racial issues in the past. Whenever there was, if it was a white fire chief, a lot of the black firefighters were upset about how things were done and vice versa. It
goes back over 40 years.
40 years. How have you seen race relations in the department in your since May?
Well,
where does it fit on the scale of things that you have to be aware of?
So I think you always have to be sensitive to all the different cultures you work with and be sensitive to where people come from and how they look at things. But at the end of the day, the sensitivity is, I was at a meeting last night, and what I explained to everybody is our job is pretty simple. We are ambassadors for people. Whether your house is on fire, like the gentleman said, or you're sick, we're their ambassadors. And that has nothing to do with race. That has to do with the job that we've accepted. And I know you asked me this question last time, and I stand by the fact that we have great opportunities. We should take advantage of those great opportunities and not try to put them in boxes or silos. The DC FEMS is here to
Fire and Emergency Medical Service.
Yes, FEMS. Sir. To take care of the residents of this district. And we have ways to deal with challenges that we have, and we will continue to do that. But I'm here to say that our job is to be the advocate for the people that call us to take care of them.
Are you prepared when the first private ambulance makes a mistake and the media descends upon you like angry bees?
Well, I think that
because that's part of the learning process too.
You have to be prepared to answer the question. The facts are the facts, and we just have to be prepared to answer the question.
Gregory Dean, he's the chief of the district's fire and EMS department. Chief Dean, thank you so much for joining us.
And he's not going to Cuba.
We'll be talking very shortly with Joel Rubin. He's a candidate for Maryland's 8th Congressional District. If you have questions or comments for Joel Rubin, you can call us at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Maryland's Legislative Black Caucus has sprung into action in opposition to some of the moves made by Governor Hogan. They accused Governor Hogan of neglecting the black residents who make up 30% of the state's population. In those in favor of those who live in the rural, mostly white areas that overwhelmingly voted for him in 2014. I think that might be the most crucial phrase in that statement.
Well, part of that was the governor killed the red line up in Baltimore.
Killed the red line in Baltimore.
And issues about the
funding for Baltimore and Prince George's County.
$40 million in special needs. And then there's going to be a new jail up there. And the governor said, well, if you don't want the jail, we'll take the money back and spread it around. I think what you're seeing is the, and I was told this just before the legislature went into session, is that the Democrats in the House and the Senate of Maryland are going to start much more aggressively opposing the Republican governor, Larry Hogan, on some of the issues he's doing. And I think that's what you're seeing. Mm-hmm. In many cases, I feel like the governor's race has already started. But that's what you're seeing. The Democrats are reasserting the fact that they run the legislature.
Joining us in studio is Joel Rubin. He's a candidate for Maryland's 8th Congressional District. Joel Rubin, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you, Kojo. Tom.
You have not held elected office before. Why did you decide to join this stampede?
Thank you for having me. This is a wonderful seat. It's a great district. I most recently was the senior official at the State Department handling the House of Representatives, an appointed position at the State Department working for Secretary Kerry. And I've gotten things done, progressive things done in Congress, in the House of Representatives through that work, as well as an activist supporting diplomacy, promoting an Iran deal over years. And we don't have time to waste, Kojo. We have major fights in the House. And for Democrats and progressives, we're looking at a majority Republican House, most likely. It's hostile territory. Mm-hmm. We've taken on these fights, and I felt like now is the time to keep it going.
It's a crowded field. 8 candidates on the Democratic side include some well-known names identified with progressive ideas, some of them who have been in public service and in elected office for a long time. How do you distinguish yourself from the others in the race and overcome the fact that you might not have the same level, at this point anyway, of name recognition that they have? How much money do you have in your pocket right now?
Well, in my pocket, I have about $40.
That's not going to do it. It's going to take more than that. How do you distinguish it?
We did well in our first quarter fundraising. We came in third of the candidates at that time with $160,000 raised, and we have used that money. We're building out a team right now. It's a data-driven campaign. I went to Carnegie Mellon for my graduate work. Believe in data and technology. My team does as well. We are right now implementing a strong field program, a digital program, and using every dollar and building up our name ID through ensuring that people understand what I've done and what we can do together. We've taken on major fights. I stood up to the Benghazi committee a year ago on behalf of the department, fought the fight for the Iran deal, arguing for it on Fox News, standing up to AIPAC, frankly, as an advocate at J Street. These are the kinds of positions that the district cares about, and they want to see someone who can fight and really take it to the House.
Well, they might say Jamie Raskin is certainly a progressive. I think you would agree with that. He's done all the local office stuff. He's trying to move up now to the congressional seat. There are other progressives who are running. It seems to me since you have not held office, the progressives are going to split the vote. Maybe somebody's more moderate, if that's possible, in the Democratic Party from the 8th District of Maryland. But someone more like Kathleen Matthews, who has a big war chest and has a name recognition from her TV world. I don't know how you break through the people who are there. And it's not a very long time to the primary. When is it? April 26th?
It's April 26th.
Right. We're coming right up on it. It's not a lot of time to build.
It's a compressed schedule. I agree. One thing that we
are you preparing to run for another office if this one is not successful? Because a lot of people do that. You know, they run for an office where they may not be likely to win, and then they can get name recognition and move on to another office.
Well, we're laser focused on this one. I chose to jump
really
into the race.
You really expect him to answer yes to that question? Yes, I'm running for this office in order to run for another office.
I was just raising the possibility because he's, you know, he. Worked for the State Department. He understands these questions.
Yeah, and you know, Tom, I appreciate the question. It's a good one. I had that question internally as well before I decided to resign my senior position at the State Department to go for this. I truly believe in this district and believe that it is the kind of district that can really lead the country on a progressive agenda. But what it needs are people who are ready on day one to hit the ground running. And in Washington, we have had a Republican majority Congress, and I know how to work with that Congress and work against it and fight it and get things done. And that is different from Annapolis. Annapolis is as we were discussing before, you were discussing earlier, is an overwhelmingly Democratic legislature, and it has achieved great things for the people of Maryland, and I'm proud to be in Maryland and be a resident of Maryland. But these are different fights, and these are different angles. I'm the only candidate in this race that has taken on the fight at the House level and seen things change. And I think that that's the kind of argument that people are getting attracted to as our name ID grows, as they are paying attention. We know from our internal polling that this is a wide open race, that for the candidates who have been in for coming up a year, they've not locked this in. And so our task is to ensure that we're getting to everybody in a very targeted manner.
I spoke to someone who's active in the State Democratic Party who had nothing but superlative things to say about you as a person, but said that you're just not well known enough in this race, and you don't have enough money. I mean, you're not David Trone, who's apparently spending all the money he made at the Total Lines on his campaign. I mean, he's written just out there everywhere.
Yes.
I mean, that's pretty difficult to match something like that.
You know,
I'm not saying David's getting a lot of benefit from it, but I'm just saying he's out there more so than you've been able to do.
And you know, I think that this is a very sophisticated district. And one of the things that we've seen over time is that this district is willing to pick the candidate that resonates with them as someone who can get the job done. Chris Van Hollen won in the competitive primary in 2002. He then beat an incumbent of 18 years. And so,
are you supporting him in his Senate race?
I haven't taken a public position, but I do believe he's wonderful, and I've supported Chris in the past, so I think he'd make a great senator. I think that Don Edwards would as well, but Chris is certainly someone that I deeply admire, and his background is one that I think fits the district, as does mine. I'm a former civil servant as well, the only one in the race who really has experienced what it's like to be in the civil service when the government gets shut down and know what that means. And that track record, I think, it speaks to the district.
You're also comfortable discussing international issues and diplomacy, including the thorny problems in the Middle East. So let's talk about that. What do you think of President Obama's accomplishments in that area? Let's start with Syria.
Thanks, Kojo. And yes, this is an area of expertise of mine. I started out as a Peace Corps volunteer after college. I'm deeply committed to international affairs and service and peace and diplomacy. And Syria is tragic. For those of us who were on the outside as well as on the inside watching it unravel, it's been devastating to see the loss of life, the refugees. I teach a graduate level class at Carnegie Mellon here in Washington on the refugees. So it is disappointing to see how we as a people have dealt with Syria. I know right now the debate has sort of boiled down to refugees, and xenophobia has crept in even at the state level.
Well, in my mind, the debate has to do with whether you can solve the problem in Syria and remove President Assad at the same time.
And that has been the dilemma the whole time. When I was at the State Department and we were working with the Congress, there were these multiple competing factors simultaneously happening. One side would say we have to get rid of Assad. Another side would say we have to build up the Free Syrian Army. Another side would say we have to combat the terrorists. It will call them ISIL, but there's many more groups.
The Russians seem to
and
have
now
made
the
their
Russians
choice. They're going to bolster Assad. That's
right.
That seems to be happening.
And one of the consequences of the opening with Iran that we now see through the diplomatic agreement on the nuclear deal is that we see Secretary Kerry and the administration pushing hard to figure out a diplomatic path out. We don't have military skin in the game, although clearly there are special forces, and there have been, that's been discussed publicly of some kind of support in that manner. But the American people do not support an American military intervention. So absent that, we need to use all of our diplomatic tools possible that we have at our disposal. I believe that in Congress, Congress is playing essentially a non-factor role in this. They were sent an AUMF, an authorization for use of, AUMF, an authorization for the use of military force request by the president when I was at the State Department. It has not acted. So essentially, the administration is flying without guidance of where the American people are. And I promise that if I were in Congress, I would be at the beginning of my tenure working as aggressively on what we're doing overseas as I am domestically. And that's a voice that we're sorely lacking
in terms of working across the aisle. I was looking at your online website. Said you would work for two Democratic senators, but I don't think you named them.
Oh, yeah. I was a congressional fellow for Senator Harkin and a foreign policy advisor for Senator Loudenberg.
Hillary or Bernie?
I support Hillary. I have seen her up close and personal, and that's why when I was a Senate staffer, Senator Loudenberg, New Jersey, she was New York, so we oftentimes did a significant amount of work together. It gets results. And when I was at the State Department working for Secretary Kerry, I returned after having left as a civil servant in the Bush administration, and the morale was inverse. And I saw that this department was working largely because she had fixed it. So from where I sit, that's the kind of leadership we need.
Here is Tim in Frederick, Maryland. Tim, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I was calling about a comment you made earlier about using data and available technology to represent your constituents. And so I was curious if you had ever considered a direct democracy campaign in which you actually let your constituents use the technology available and vote on the bills you will be voting on as their representative. And if they have a democratically determined position, if you would commit to representing that with your vote.
So one of my professors in undergraduate at Brandeis University, Jeffrey Abramson, wrote a book called The Electronic Commonwealth back in the early 90s, and is an outstanding work way before the tools that we currently have were available. I think you have to get as much input as possible. And I learned that as an activist at J Street, when we were essentially taking on AIPAC and taking on the status quo on American foreign policy in the Middle East at a time when President Bush was in the White House, we used online tools to engage people through online appeals, actions, getting buy-in. I am an active believer in citizen participation. It may be a
conversation. But do leaders sometimes have to take unpopular positions? Do you simply find out what your constituents want, stick your finger in the wind and say, okay, that's where I'm going to go?
This is the debate of the time. The concern that the American people have, and that I have personally as well as someone who, as you point out, is not a self-financed billionaire, is that the millionaires and billionaires essentially crowd out the other voices. That we can't have. That doesn't mean that every bill that hits the House floor needs to have an electronic vote from all of the constituents, because that's not practical. And you'll see different weights lead into the voting. But one does need to integrate that into the inputs as how the decisions are made.
I'm not sure how it would work if you, I mean, we have in the city the human rights bill, and some people wanted to put onto the ballot whether or not the city would approve same-sex marriage. And the human rights, our law says that you can't put that, you couldn't put that on the ballot. But would you, and is this democratic democracy, a direct democracy, would you vote on things like that?
Well, again, in terms of...
Sounds like it would be unworkable. That's why we have a representative democracy.
Well, I think at the federal level, ultimately, the thing that's most concerning to me, if I may, about this race is looking at the numbers that end up voting for this seat. We're probably talking about 10% of the actual population living within District 8 will vote in this primary in late April. And it's such a solid Democratic seat that it's likely that will be the person who takes it in the general. And then they'll stay for 10 years because of incumbency. Something has to untie that Gordian knot. The gerrymandering issue is part and parcel of that. I think that it harms our participation levels, and we need to amp up participation to get good results.
This is not the South Carolina primary where it gets pretty brutal down there. But why is it Kathleen Matthews a good candidate. Wasn't David Trohn, wasn't Jamie Raskin the three with the most money? I mean, other than the fact that they have the money, you wouldn't turn it down, if I guess, if you had it. Can you just say briefly why Kathleen Matthews shouldn't be elected to Congress and you should be?
What I bring, which is distinct, and what I think the voters of the district do appreciate, is someone who has gotten results in the House of Representatives in a hostile environment and on progressive issues. And that's distinct from the other candidates. And
she says she's done that at Marriott. She's helped enlighten the corporate Marriott Corporation, which wasn't all that friendly to unions or same-sex people or other things.
And I think ultimately, you know, if the voters, I'll submit, if they're able to take us all in and look at where the experiences are and what the job is that people are getting done, I hope at least that they'll look at the facts of getting things done in the House as the core qualifier for working in the House.
And Jamie Raskin has been in the trenches, and you say Congress is different from General Assembly, but is there something about him that you would say don't vote for him, vote for me?
It's interesting because I oftentimes have people come up to me and say, well, you're another liberal Jewish guy, initials JR. We already have one of those in the race. Why do we need you? And my argument is, look, I'm nearly 45. I have nearly 20 years of public service experience. My wife and I, we live in the district. We have three young daughters. My mother-in-law lives with us. We're a multi-generational, multi-racial household. We were civil servants. We reflect the district. And I know how to get things done in Congress in a hostile environment and have taken on fights as an advocate, in addition to being appointed and trusted by the Secretary of State to lead our charge into the Republican House. And I think that's a unique tool set.
Two major unions announced their endorsements in this race. Delegate Kumar Barve got the support of hotel and casino workers. Jamie Raskin got your endorsement of the union representing food and cafeteria workers. David Trohn getting his support from the business community, meaning himself. Who do you see as your base of support in this campaign? We only have about 40 seconds.
My base of support are the people who are civil servants and people who care deeply about public service and live in the district. People who care about international affairs as well have been strongly supportive. I haven't spent the last decade building up endorsements from local groups because I have been working as an activist and I was in the administration working on behalf of the taxpayer. I applaud all the endorsements. My base of support, I believe, are the people like me who are trying to make sure that we have the best country for our kids we can.
Joel Rubin, good luck to you.
Thank you,
sir. Joel Rubin is a candidate for Maryland's 8th Congressional District. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the current newspapers. You'll be covering tomorrow,
Judge Scalia's funeral.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Namdi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at WAMU.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.